This week, the United States and South Korea failed to reach an agreement on how to share the costs for U.S. troops deployed on the Korean Peninsula. The two countries had failed to come to an agreement last December as well, ultimately settling on a one-year deal in February of this year, where South Korea increased its contributions from around $800 million to nearly $1 billion. In the current round of negotiations, the Trump administration has sought a 400% increase, a payment of $4.7 billion that will cover the entire cost of U.S. troop deployment and more. The position of the U.S. government has elicited concerns both in South Korea and the United States. Longtime policy watchers have raised worries that this may weaken the alliance at a vital juncture in U.S. engagements in the region, or push South Korea to take radical steps to better protect itself against the North Korean threat, such as the acquisition of nuclear weapons. Our guest today is one of the original architects of the burden-sharing agreement between the United States and the Republic of Korea. He is also a longtime policy practitioner who worked on U.S.-Korea relations. He joins us today to provide his view of relations between the two countries. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Foreign Minister Song Min-soon was a career diplomat in the South Korean Foreign Service for over 30 years. In 1991 and 2001, he led the Status of Forces Agreement negotiations with the United States, which determined the cost-sharing for U.S. troops deployed in South Korea. He was also South Korea's chief negotiator to the six-party talks, multilateral efforts to denuclearize North Korea, and was the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Trade from 2006 to 2008. Thank you, Minister Song, for making time and being with us today.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
First and foremost, would you tell the audiences a little about how you joined the South Korean Foreign Service? Were there early inspirations that led you to this career?
In our system, we have to join the military service, mostly during the college years. After four semesters in college, I had to go to military service in the front line. During that service, I got to know the reality of the division of the country. I had some conscience about why did I come to military service while I was in college. So that's because of the division of the country. So I slowly got the motivation that in my life, I would better devote myself to overcoming the division of the country. And then I selected the foreign ministry because Korea was divided by foreign countries, the surrounding countries. They pulled apart the Korean Peninsula for their national interest. So I thought this external factor, foreign policy, is very important for the future of the country. And that is the basic reason I started to prepare to join the foreign service.
And one of your earlier postings as a very young diplomat, you were in the United States.
Yes.
What were your impressions of the United States then? And what were your impressions of the bilateral relationship between South Korea and the United States when you were a young diplomat?
When I served here, it was before the end of the Cold War. Well, at that time, what Washington said was largely accepted as true. And what Washington did was largely accepted as good for other countries as well. Now, that prevails no more. You know, people think the United States is doing for its own interest, not for the general interest of the world, general system of the world. That's a great change. And then secondly, in the bilateral relations between Seoul and Washington, in the 1980s, Korea was still regarded as a developing country. But with the 1988 Olympic Games in Seoul, Korea was regarded as a developed country. So accordingly, Seoul-Washington relations transit from the helping and the helped, but more of this balanced. So we, at that time, we graduated, for example, FMS, foreign military sales. There is some the Americans were doing for the allies of a poor economy for military equipment. So that kind of transition happened. That's a big difference between then and now. At that time, we were just starting to shoulder some financial burden for American forces and the modicum amount. But now, Washington is asking huge amounts for keeping American forces. It's a big, a phenomenal change.
And you, as a diplomat, you oversaw the entirety of that huge arc, first as a young diplomat posted in the United States, as you mentioned, when South Korea was much more of a dependent ally. And then later in the 2000s, as foreign minister, you oversaw South Korea that became more confident and more of an equal partner in the alliance. As foreign minister, you saw several challenging issues, including North Korea's nuclear provocations and growing public discussions around wartime operational control of South Korean soldiers. Are there any issues that stand out as the biggest challenge that you confronted in the new era where South Korea, as you mentioned, after the 1988 Olympics, after South Korea graduated from all these
preferential systems?
Right, yeah. Preferential systems. Were there any challenges that you faced as foreign minister?
Well, actually, all these issues you just enumerated are interrelated. You cannot separate them. But for me, the most challenging issue was North Korean nuclear threat. The North Korean nuclear issue is actually the basis for all other complicated issues, you know. For example, operational control transition is also directly related to North Korean nuclear problem. In my memory, I spent a lot of time on how to make a progress in the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, what we generally terms, but actually how to stop North Korea's nuclear ambition. We cannot do it overnight, but I tried to make a progress in irreversible way, even though I could not make it in speedy way. But when you look back at this problem, denuclearization issue was moving ahead, one step ahead, and then one step back. In the meantime, North Korea was declared, and it was regarded as an actual nuclear weapon state. But in retrospect, I have to say that this nuclear issue was most daunting and challenging one.
And you, of course, beyond your role as foreign minister, you were also the chief negotiator for South Korea in the six-party talks, where there was a multilateral effort to denuclearize North Korea. Of course, today we have a different system in place. We've seen President Trump take a more personal action in terms of negotiations with North Korea on a more bilateral, top-down approach. Do you have any comments, or what is your sense for that kind of transition? Do you see this as something that is beneficial to the process, or how do you see the current U.S. negotiations strategy with North Korea?
This is something like an apple and orange. You cannot take just one side, whether it is top-down or bottom-up. When Trump came, people thought as if this top-down is a sort of panacea. It can solve everything. No? Never. When you look into the tenet of this issue, North Korea cannot give up its nuclear option overnight because they depend everything on it. Because North Korean nuclear asset is important for the regime politically, militarily, and economically. So Kim Jong-un, even he wants to decide in the top-down fashion, it cannot be accepted by his colleagues. We usually say that Kim Jong-un decides everything, but I don't think it is true. North Korea is a country where 25 million people and the long-established ruling elite, and when they regard it is nuclear option is discarded, they know that they lose everything. So this top-down is needed, but important thing is it should be approached from bottom-up as well. Mm-hmm. So this combination of top-down and bottom-up, in retrospect, just in the last couple of years, people thought as if, oh, okay, when Trump and Kim Jong-un decide, everything will be solved. That was fantasy.
Within all this, there's the importance of the engagement between the two countries, both bottom-up and top-down, in a very robust process. But I think we can also agree that the U.S.-South Korea alliance has to be a firm basis for engagement with North Korea. But right now, today, we do have certain challenges in the U.S.-Korea relationship, particularly around the cost-sharing agreement, which has caused a lot of tensions between the two countries over how to share the cost for U.S. troops deployed in South Korea. Mm-hmm. Of course, you were part of the negotiating team. You led the negotiations for the initial breakdown of costs between South Korea and the United States on U.S. troop deployment. How have the discussions between South Korea and the United States changed since your time in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and today?
I was one of the architects of this special measure agreement for cost sharing concluded in 1990, and then actual sharing started in 1991. From then on, the underlying principle was to share the cost based on the principle that some locally incurred cost shall be borne by Korea, host nation, and the other cost than that should be borne by the sending country, the United States. That's in the firm principle. But lately, Trump administration just discarded all this principle and all of a sudden asked $5 billion per year, not $5 billion for 5 years. Yeah. This is not a matter of the amount, but matter of principle. When United States unilaterally decide and demand exact from the Republic of Korea, then Korean people would think that the United States is too much one-sided. I'm so much sad about this reality. You know, in 1990, when we were first negotiating on this cost sharing, we were discussing it behind the screen and quietly at the hotel room in Honolulu, and what revealing this discrepancy so much. But now this is a negotiation on the street.
Very public disagreement to some degree. What is your sense for why the United States has changed its position so much?
Well, I think we see it as a trend. Mm-hmm. As a trend, I think it is inevitable. The host nation like Korea shoulder more burden incrementally within that framework of the principle. No? But now, this Trump administration is doing something beyond this principle and very abrupt and very unacceptable manner. When we see the trend, I think the size of American economy in whole global economy reduced from more than 30% of the global product now reduced to 20-something. So relatively, United States is the superpower, the strongest, the richest. But relatively, it is not as high as it was before. But some other countries like China, Germany, and some medium countries like Korea enhance its portion in the global economy. So it is natural for allies who got richer shoulder more burden. But it should be incremental in accordance with this change of economic size. But think about this, 500% increase. This is something like Trump's tactic of winning through intimidation. That is destructive.
It is very alarming when you frame it that way. You've written prolifically about this issue, about the tensions between the United States and South Korea over cost sharing. And in one of the articles, you mentioned that negotiations between South Korea and the United States, the United States, as you mentioned, is... You know, this tactic of intimidation is also being used to signal to other allies, to Japan, to European countries. Mm-hmm. Could you speak more in depth about why you believe the United States started with South Korea first? Why was this intimidation not employed first to, say, Germany or Japan? Why did this SMA discussion become so intensified with South Korea first before other allies?
Well, there are two elements. Firstly, because of the time factor, the U.S.-Japan negotiation is going to start next year. Mm. But Korea-U.S. negotiation actually started 1 year earlier, but they could not agree on this five-year plan. So this is a sort of sequence matter. And secondly, President Trump and his people may think that South Korea is most directly exposed to North Korean nuclear threat. So Koreans want to have some kind of Korean Peninsula version of nuclear balance. But the United States says that you don't need to have your own nuclear weapon to make a nuclear balance. But instead, United States will provide this nuclear umbrella. But here comes the last point. Okay, the cost for that umbrella will be decided by us. That's what Korean people also presume. So this factor is actually not acceptable. this alliance should be based on the mutual interest. And the way to protect and to be protected should be also agreed upon mutually.
Right. You gave a very startling statistics about how between when you first negotiated the special measures agreement and today, the cost that the South Koreans have borne in the U.S. deployment of troops in South Korea has increased
six times,
while South Korea's GDP has only increased five times. So South Korea is paying more quickly than their economy is growing. Could you give a sense for broadly what South Korea is currently paying? And perhaps if you could give us a sense for how you think the United States is calculating their $4.7 billion demand.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what is the basis for this $4.7 billion. I think roughly Washington is basing this demand on total cost of American forces in Korea. But as we have seen this former USFK commander, Walter Sharp, mentioned, there is no spreadsheet for American forces stationing cost. We Korean people regard that Trump is demanding the whole total cost of stationing American forces in Korea plus alpha, like a premium for American forces protection. That is a serious thing. It will be really and gravely degrade the identity of American forces in Korea.
In the eyes of the Korean people.
I think not only in the eyes of the Korean people, but also other onlookers all over the world. Oh, Americans are asking every cost of their sending troops to the host nations and sometimes plus alpha. What is this? And then the important thing is American forces in Korea cannot enjoy the general respect among Korean populace. Largely, 70 and more percentage of Korean people say gratitude for American forces for protecting us and contributing to stability and peace. But when they regard, oh, they came here for money, what would happen then?
In response to these developments, in response to the U.S. demands, South Korea obviously has the opportunity in negotiations to make a counterproposal. In your view, what would you say is a fair amount that South Korea could increase its payments to? Or is it already at a fair level?
We cannot make an exact judgment on what is fair. But my principle in my past record of negotiation and judgment is that ultimately Korea should pay the whole portion of the locally incurred cost. For example, the supply Korean labor workforces and building military sites and other logistic supports. So this locally incurred cost should be borne by Korean government. And the other cost, for example, the sending troops, transporting them, giving them salaries and allowances and supporting their families, and providing the military equipment for American forces, not for Korean forces, you know. Equipment and operating them and maintaining them, and these things should be borne by sending countries. Mm-hmm. I think this is some reasonable divide. Mm-hmm. So important thing is how can we categorize these elements in some articulate way.
In your writings, you call for South Korea to shift from a dependent alliance to a self-supporting alliance. Could you give us a better sense for the difference between the two and what actions you think South Korea is currently taking to become a self-supporting ally?
We are allies, the friends. The friends should be individually self-supporting. If one friend is dependent upon the other friend, this friendship it cannot sustain long. You know, it is burdensome. South Korea should not keep an unnecessary burden on the shoulder of America, of the United States. So now, because of this, particularly this operational control matter, South Korean army, South Korean military forces are largely depending on the United States. So Korea should be more self-supporting. If that happens, what would happen? Then United States can be relieved of the burden on the depending Korean Peninsula in case of contingencies. You can be more flexible in diverting your forces to other areas when Korea keeps its own self-supporting army. That is the basic reason. So we have to approach it in the concept of from cost sharing to burden sharing. We, Korea and the United States, has a common security burden, means keeping peace and stability in the region and more broadly. So if Korea got the self-supporting, we can relieve the burden on the United States for whole, you know, regional security and stability. That is the point I am emphasizing.
And of course, to build a more robust self-defense architecture in South Korea, it requires obviously resources. Yes. And I think what you're suggesting is that these resources that South Korea has would be better spent in South Korea becoming a larger bearer of the burden, rather than giving that resource in monetary form to the United States.
Yes, in that sense, you see, Korea is the largest spender in terms of GDP ratio among American allies. We are spending 2.56% of GDP on defense, and higher than any other major U.S. allies. So it means we are working toward this self-reliant military capability. But if we divert from this defense budget to this cost sharing, we cannot buy the weapons from American producers. We cannot improve our military capability. And then South Korean military will continue to be burdensome on the United States.
This is obviously a risk factor that the United States is not considering in its current negotiations on cost sharing. Are there other broader issues that you feel that the United States is not taking into account in its current talks with South Korea?
Lately, President Trump and his people insinuate that if Korea does not pay enough to their expectation for American forces in Korea, there is a probability of reducing or withdrawing American forces from Korea. I think the consequence will be simple. Korean people would take its own way of protecting themselves. That is to make a new nuclear balance on the peninsula. In that case, it would be the road to the demise of nuclear nonproliferation regime. For example, for the South Korea and Japan, staying away from nuclear ambition, even though they are confronting with nuclear-armed adversaries like North Korea, China, and Russia, the premise is that the United States provides so-called extended deterrence and nuclear umbrella. But there, when there is a possibility that the United States is withholding this umbrella, they will certainly make their own choice for nuclear umbrella, you know. That is something we have to keep in mind. I think it is a natural consequence. I find some analogy in the case of East Asia and Europe. Lately, we have seen that France and Germany are thinking about their common nuclear capabilities in preparation for possible retreat of the United States from European front. That would be happening in East Asia as well. That's natural.
And, of course, it would not necessarily lead to a more stable and secure Northeast Asia.
That would be somewhat catastrophic.
Right, right. To close, Mr. Song, are there things that you feel American audiences often misunderstand about South Korea, and in particular about the U.S.-Korea relationship?
Korea and the United States have been keeping this alliance almost 70 years. The very foundation of this alliance is to deter the threat to South Korea as well as to the United States. And then we have been succeeding in pursuing that objective. In that process, Korean people certainly appreciate so much and express great gratitude for Americans coming to us to protect us. But on this other side, Korea is located on the front line of the American interest in terms of military and security, just in front line. So when you are situated in the front line, you bear the brunt of all threats and the possible attack. So United States should also understand. I don't like to ask Americans to appreciate it, but you have to recognize that, oh, Koreans are bearing the brunt in the front line. That's one thing I'm asking to be understood by Americans. With that, I think Korea has been contributing to containing a potential threat from either major rivals of the United States. So it means our alliance is not one-sided. It's reciprocal. It's for mutual interest. And we have to keep this alliance and develop this alliance based on the mutually accepted principles.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Minister Song Min-soon for joining us today. If you're interested in further exploring the topic of burden sharing, you can view the KEI event on U.S. Approach to Defense Burden Sharing in the link provided in the show notes. In addition, please also consider reading KEI fellow Kyle Ferrier's paper on the monetary value of Korea's contributions to U.S. foreign policy, also in the show notes. This is the final episode of 2019. Korean Context will return in January with new episodes. Until then, you can find all of our events from 2019 on YouTube, and please also consider perusing the Peninsula blog for discussions on topics ranging from South Korea's 5G adoption to the effectiveness of sanctions on North Korea. Happy holidays, and see you soon.